welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's past. I'm your host, Mark Levonier, Mystery in this hour. Later on, it's Nightbeat from 1950, but first, The Weird Circle, with an episode called The Murder of the Little Pig, from March 5th, 1944, on NBC.
Out of the past, phantoms of a world gone by speak again the immortal tale, The Murder of the Little Pig.
Down, Coquette! Down, I say. Now go to your corner.
Well, come in, Monsieur Lahan. This is a surprise.
Excuse my dropping in like this, Monsieur Lecoq, but I must see you.
Well, yes, of course.
It's a pretty tough customer you've got there.
Coquette?
Oh, she's only bluffing.
Please make yourself comfortable. Now, Coquette, stay in your corner. Coquette?
Isn't that the dog that was the principal witness in your last case?
Yes, and if she only could have talked, I would have not had such a difficult time. But you've come to see me about something, my friend. What is it?
Well, you know, Lecoq, I've been plaguing you for years to let me write up some of your interesting criminal cases. You know, are probably the most popular citizen of Paris.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes, you are. Certainly the greatest detective of our time. Why, people weigh your least word. Just imagine how they devour one of your stories, fictionized.
But...
Now, you aren't putting me off any longer. My paper says get Lecoq's stories or get out. You don't want to see me lose my job.
Oh, hardly. All right, my young friend Lahan, you bearded me at last in my own den. But I've known a lifetime of crime. Where would I begin?
Well, what about your last case, which involved the dog, Coquette?
Indeed, why not? That was a baffling mystery. It had a strange, unearthly element, which has never been explained. And it centered around a very pretty woman.
Well, it sounds made to order. And, by the way, how did you happen to acquire the dog?
Well, that's part of the story. We'll come to that. Now, let me think a bit about this story. Maybe I should refer to my notes. It's file number 23. Yes, and here it is. The Murder of the Little Pig.
Well, there's one murder, pigs?
This kind, monsieur. You know how Parisians are. They're forever giving names to people whose appearance or personality reminds them of animals. In French criminal history, we've had the wolf, the fox, the rabbit... The leopard?
That's true.
And the little hairdresser, Henri Coudray, was called the little pig. Well, it was past midnight when I received word to hurry to the Rue Batignolles that murder had been done. When I arrived, the police commissioner took me to the scene of the crime. And there on the bedroom floor, the body lay in the position in which it had fallen.
Well, there's little for you to do in this case, Lecoq. Old Henri Coudray, called the Little Pig, has been stabbed to death, and we know who the murderer is.
Oh, well, that's pretty fast work, isn't it? Or was the murderer caught in the act?
No, the murdered man himself enlightened us. Look. Mm-hmm. Look there on the floor beside the body.
Say, that's a name written in blood on the parquet floor. It's a gruesome sight, isn't it? What is the word? It's M-O-N-I-S.
Monish, huh? The first half of the name Monistro, nephew of the murdered man. Huh. A little pig died before he could finish the name, but he gave us enough. You see, Jean Monistro is the sole heir to Coudray's large fortune. Huh, what a cinch of a case.
You think the old man started to write the name of his murderer in his own blood?
What else is there to think?
Well, I don't know. Have you noticed the expression on the face of the corpse? Death must have been instantaneous because Coudray died calm and smiling. His assailant must have been known to him.
Of course Coudray knew his own nephew.
Yeah, but only a hope of revenge could have given so much energy to a dying old man. Imagine how desperately he would struggle to write the name. Why, every split second would count. He knew his life was expiring. And have you noticed something else, Commissioner? The name is written on the right side of the body.
And written with the forefinger of the right hand. Oh, come now, Lecoq. This is a simple case. Don't try to make something complicated out of you. I'll convince you. I want you to hear the testimony of the caretaker. Well, Jacques. Jacques, come in here a minute.
Yes, monsieur.
Now, will you tell Monsieur Lecoq what happened last evening?
Oh, yes, monsieur. Gladly. It was about 9 o'clock when the little pig's nephew, Jean Monistro, came to see his uncle.
Mm-hmm. Did you see Monistro face to face?
Well, no, monsieur. You see, My apartment is on the first floor.
Yeah.
And John had already started to walk up the stairs when I looked out my door.
Oh, so then you only saw the man's back?
Well, yes, monsieur. But he had on a suit I had seen John wear time and time again. Hmm. If I did not see his face, I did see his little black dog, Coquette.
Our chief witness, Lecoq, is the little black dog. For it was he who witnessed the murder.
But tell me, Jacques, exactly what happened?
Well, monsieur, nothing really happened. I saw Jean going upstairs and the dog Coquette tagging along behind.
Mm-hmm.
That was at 9 o'clock. And then at about 9:30... I'm a great one to look at my watch, monsieur.
That's it?
At 9:30, I heard the entrance door open and I saw Jean Monistro leave the building with the dog.
Commissioner, what time do you fix the murder?
Between 9:15 and 9:30.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jacques, did you see Jean Monistro's face as he left the house?
Well, no, monsieur. I only saw his back. But I would swear it was Jean, all right.
There's no doubt it was Jean Monistro who killed his uncle to get his inheritance. I've ordered my men to arrest Monistro.
Yes. Commissioner, have you observed that the night table is on the left side of the bed? And there's a newspaper dropped to the left of that chair. And an empty wine glass on the left of the desk.
Oh, go home and go to bed, Lecoq. I'm not going to let you make a mystery out of this plain, simple case.
I know, but I can't reconcile the peaceful, smiling expression on the face of the corpse with that writing on the floor in blood. I feel in my bones that Jean Monistro is innocent.
Yeah, come in, come in.
Commissioner, we've arrested Jean Monistro.
Have any trouble with him?
No, monsieur. Monistro has confessed to the crime.
Well, I left the scene of the crime with my opinion unchanged. Though indeed my face should have been red, what with my innocent Jean confessing. And the first witnesses I examined only strengthened the state's case to establish his guilt.
Really?
Yes. I talked first to Marie, wife of Jacques, the caretaker. Marie, I believe, was an habitual eavesdropper. In any case, 3 days before the murder, Jean and his wife Clara called on the little pig Coudray, and listening in the hall, Marie overheard the uncle say...
So you visit your old uncle in the middle of the week. Huh? Never heard of such a thing. Now, don't tell me you're getting so fond of me that you can't wait until your usual Sunday visit.
We've come to see you about something special, dear Uncle Henri.
Not that we don't want to see you at any time.
Well, you don't say. You'd never expressed yourselves in such affectionate terms before. You must want something. Well, out with it. Out with it. My friends are waiting for me at the cafe for my usual glass of wine and game of cards. I can't keep them waiting all night.
Well, you see, Uncle, business is not going very well with me.
How can you run a jewelry business, Uncle, without plenty of stock? Jean simply can't design and make decent pieces.
Yes, I don't have enough stock on hand, not enough variety in jewels, and not enough general equipment. And now I have a chance to buy a jeweler's stock at the Palais Royal for 100,000 francs.
100,000 francs?
Yes.
That's a very great deal of money, Jean. Took me many years to save that much money.
But you wouldn't miss it, Uncle. And it'll put Jean on his feet.
On his feet? Or on his head? I'm not really concerned where Jean finds himself, my dear Clara. After my death, you two may throw away my money as you see fit. But until death closes these eyes, I intend to keep my money and enjoy it. Yes, all of it.
No wonder you're called the little pig.
Clara, hold your temper.
Why should I? At last, I'm going to tell him what I really think of him.
You were even more beautiful, Madame Clara, when you were angry. But you should watch your words. I just might take it into my head to leave all my lovely money to a foundation for stray cats.
I don't care what you do with it. The money will do us no good when we're too old to enjoy it. We need 100,000 francs now. Now!
Oh, come, Clara. It's no use.
Mm-hmm. Jean is wise, Clara. I couldn't even part with 100,000 francs I've worked so hard to earn.
So hard to earn. All Paris knows how you earned your fortune.
Clara.
The rich, silly women whose hair you dressed talked too much, didn't they?
Clara.
I told you enough so that you could find out more. And you blackmailed them, one after the other. You blackmailed them.
Oh, Uncle, don't pay any attention to Clara. You know how impulsive she is. She doesn't know what she's saying.
I'm too old to hold grudges. Well, come now. My friends at the cafe are waiting. Good night, children. Good night. Watch the stairs. The hall is dark.
Pig. You little pig. Oh, Marie. You nearly tripped me. What are you doing out here in the hall?
Oh,
Merely cleaning up, madame.
This time of night, what do you take me for? Well, I'm glad you know now what kind of a man dear Uncle Henri is.
Come along, Clara. You've said enough.
Marie, when you bring up Uncle's cafe au lait in the morning, put a little arsenic in it for me, will you?
Go on, madame, while you talk.
Well, I hate the little pig. I'd kill him if I could.
Come, Clara, come. You shouldn't say such things.
Well, Marie's story made my theory of Jean's innocence seem very weak indeed.
Oh, I should think so.
Still, I insisted that when Jean left his uncle's house that night, he was not as yet a man driven to murder. Why, Jean wasn't even angry. Mm-hmm. He was not temperamentally the type to murder in cold blood.
I see.
But, Lahan, early in the morning after the murder, a surprise witness brought the guillotine even nearer to Jean Monistrol. A well-dressed matron, Madame Dupont, told us this story. On the day previous, at some 10 hours or so before the crime, Madame Dupont went to Jean Monistrol's shop in the Rue Vivienne.
Ah, good morning, Madame Dupont.
Good morning, Monsieur Monistrol. I am returning the bracelet.
Oh, is there anything wrong? I thought I had repaired it very skillfully.
This is not the bracelet I brought to you, Monsieur. You have substituted paste for my genuine stones.
Oh, I've done no such thing. I'll let you look at them through my glass. But I see you are right. Well, these are substitutes. Oh, I swear to you, madame, I don't know how it happened. I don't know what to say.
Perhaps your wife will know what to say.
What do you mean by that, madame?
Your wife was in the shop yesterday when I called for the bracelet. I thought she acted very strangely. She avoided looking at me and was eager for me to leave. She is not a good thief, monsieur.
But I can't believe that Clara would do such a thing.
Well, if you didn't remove the stones, monsieur, who else except your wife had the opportunity?
No one. No one. Clara knows the work well enough to make the substitutions herself.
Yeah.
Oh, I see it all. Poor Clara's been worried half sick. We need money, and my uncle refused to help us. Clara did this thing for me.
You love your wife very much, don't you, monsieur?
Oh, yes, very much, madame. I swear I'll get the jewels back for you. Please, please don't go to the police.
Why do you think I've come to you, monsieur? I could have gone at once to the police. But I am a sentimental woman, and I have eyes in my head. One doesn't often see a man so much in love with his wife.
Oh, then you will promise to wait a little. I'll get the jewels back for you.
But what if she's already sold them? What if she spent the money? Can you buy such valuable jewels?
Don't worry, madame. I'll get the money. I'll get it somehow.
So you see, Lahan, Madame Dupont furnished the state with the strongest possible motive in the case against Jean Monistrol.
Yes, I see.
But doubt as to his guilt persistently tugged at my mind. It was still early morning, and Jean had not been examined since his confession on the previous night. I wanted to get to him before he became exhausted and confused with the questions of others. I found Jean sullen in his cell and unwilling to talk.
I have nothing to say, monsieur. I've confessed. What more do you want?
But why did you confess, Jean?
That's a queer question. I guess the answer is, I'm a man who doesn't know how to hold out. Hadn't gotten away with a murder, I think...
Jean, where did you buy the revolver you used?
I had it in my possession a long time. Years, I guess.
What did you do with it after you killed your uncle?
I threw it into the Seine.
Your little black dog, Coquette, misses you, Jean. She won't eat.
I wish I could have her here with me. She was a one-man dog. Coquette followed me everywhere. Please go now, monsieur. I've no more to say to you.
I left Jean now convinced that he was innocent. But where in all Paris would I find the guilty one? I decided next to go to the Rue Vivienne and call on Madame Clara.
What can I do for you, monsieur? No one is here. I mean to say, poor monsieur is away and madame is just leaving.
Well, who are you, young woman?
Sybil, madame's maid. Now, if you wish to leave an order, or if you wish to buy anything...
I'm not here to buy, mademoiselle. I am Lecoq of the police department.
Oh.
I must speak to madame Monistrol.
Oh, my goodness, monsieur. Right away. Madame. Madame.
I'm right here, Sybil. I heard what the gentleman said. Down, Coquette. Go on, go back. Go back in the room. Take him with you.
Come along, Coquette. That's a good dog.
Well, you have a very good watchdog, madame.
Jewelers keep good watchdogs, monsieur.
Does your dog never make up to strangers?
No, never. Coquette really only likes my husband. Why are you here? I heard you say you're from the police department.
Yes. Here is my identification.
I see. Well, perhaps you know I've received a summons to appear at court this afternoon for examination. I must leave in a few moments.
Yes, I know, but I wanted to speak to you before you left. Do you think your husband is innocent, madame?
I'm sure of it. Jean couldn't kill a fly.
So it has seemed to me. Jean is not the type to kill even a fly. But you know that your husband has confessed.
I'm sure that Jean is convinced that I killed his uncle. He knew how I hated Uncle Henri. And then I did something foolish, monsieur.
Oh?
We needed money, and I borrowed some jewels. I believe that Jean found it out. But he didn't know that I still have the jewels, and I'm going to give them back to Madame Dupont. I'm sure he thought I was desperate, that I'd sold the jewels, spent the money, and then got frightened and killed his uncle, whom I hated, so that we could get the inheritance.
You have your husband's reasoning pretty well figured out, haven't you, madame?
Oh, but I know Jean so well.
Did you kill his uncle?
No, monsieur. And I have three witnesses that I was home that night. It was hot, and I asked three neighbor ladies in to have ice cream with me. They were here from 9 o'clock till after 10.
Well, if you have three witnesses, you have indeed a perfect alibi. But where was your husband at that time?
Well, it's quite unfortunate, but Jean went to see a workman about making some artificial pearls.
Uh-huh.
Everything was unlucky that night for Jean. The workman wasn't at home. And I haven't been able to find anyone who saw Jean all evening.
What time did he leave the house?
About 8:30. He came home about 10:30. I know what you're thinking. Jean was away at exactly the right time for him to have gone to his uncle's apartment and killed him and returned. But I know Jean's innocent. I know it.
Where was the dog during the evening?
Coquette?
Hmm.
It's a funny question. Well, I didn't notice where the dog went. Still, I believe Coquette followed her master. Yes, I'm sure she must have followed Jean.
Lehand, Madame Clara was from first to last a mystery to me. When I left the shop, I decided to question Madame Clara's neighbors and find out what they thought of her. They talked readily.
A pretty woman, but extravagant.
Madame Clara has admirers, lots of admirers.
I don't know anything about her. Madame is discreet.
She drove her husband to the crime, that's what I think.
Yes, she had lots of admirers, but who can say one thing wrong about her?
And while talking to Madame Clara's neighbors, the idea came to me which I was sure would put me on the trail I was seeking.
Well, what was that?
I had already seen Madame leave the house, so I knew I could find the maid, Sybil, alone when I returned to the shop.
Oh, Monsieur, Madame has left.
Oh, well, that's unfortunate. Madame gave me the name of a friend of hers, and I've lost the card it was written on. Now, a bright girl like you wouldn't be so careless, would you, Sybil?
Oh, Monsieur, you have a good memory. You remembered my name.
And I couldn't easily forget. The name goes with such a pretty face.
Oh, Monsieur, now you joke with me.
No, Sybil, I'm entirely sincere before such youthful charm.
Oh.
And I can see how bright you are, too. I'll bet you can tell me the name of that gentleman. You know, he's the only man beside Monsieur Monistro himself, the only other person the dog Coquette would follow.
Oh, you mean Monsieur Victor.
Exactly, Victor. How silly of me to forget such a simple name. And his address was... Oh, let me
see. Oh, Trudeau, number 23. It's not far from here.
Yes, of course. It's hard to account for the affections of animals, isn't it? Now, Croquette is unfriendly to everyone, so I'm told, to everyone outside the immediate family, and yet she's so friendly with Monsieur Victor that she would actually follow him.
Oh, well, you see, Monsieur Victor used to own Coquette, but he gave her as a present to Madame and Monsieur Ministro because they needed a watchdog. Oh, but Coquette still loves her former master. She often visits him.
Well, that's a quaint habit, isn't it? But I suppose the Ministros must lock up the dog so she doesn't go off visiting at night.
Oh, they don't bother to lock her up if they're staying home.
No?
Coquette often runs over to Monsieur Victor's after supper around 7 and doesn't come back before 10. That is, if she can get out. Hmm. Now, this week, Coquette's been a regular gadabout. She's been over to Monsieur Victor's every single night.
I knew before I was out of the Rue Vivienne the course of action I would take. It was bold, but it would save weeks of investigation. As you know, Lehand, it's in my character to take risks, and when I'm near the solution of a case, I'm inclined to be dramatic.
Yes, I know.
And especially in a case like this, where the evidence is purely circumstantial. Well, it took 3 days to study the house and the habits of Monsieur Victor and to make other careful preparations. But it was an uncanny and strange circumstance that finally turned the case. On the fourth night, according to plan, Monsieur Victor was kept out very late. When he reached his apartment, he went to bed promptly and then to sleep very quickly, for he had been drinking a great deal of wine. But presently, Monsieur Victor was awakened by a voice, by an unforgettable voice.
Monsieur Victor, wake up. Wake up, Monsieur Victor.
Who are you?
You know who I am well enough. I am Andre Coudray, the old man you murdered.
Go away. Go away, little pig. Leave me in peace. Why do you come every night like this? Why do you stand there and look at me like that with that ghastly smile and the cut in your throat? Oh, go away, go away!
No, monsieur. It's no good hiding your head. I will come back and come back until I have driven you out of your mind.
But what do you want? What do you want?
Why did you kill me? Any man has a right to know why he was killed.
If I tell you, will you go away? Will you promise never to come back?
Yes, I promise. Now, tell me, and I will stay quite silently dead.
All right. All right, I'll tell you. I love Clara. I dressed like Jean, took the dog Coquette to your house and killed you. And now Jean will go to the guillotine. Clara will inherit your money, and in time we shall be married. I killed three birds with one stone. Got rid of you and Jean, and Clara will have your money.
Very clever, Monsieur Victor. And you wrote part of Jean's last name in my blood on the floor, didn't you?
Yes, yes, that finished it. Now go back. Go back to your grave and stay there.
All right, men, grab him.
Right. Oh.
You're under arrest, Louis Victor.
No.
Stanton, turn up the light.
Danton, are you stuck?
I got him.
What is this?
Take that gun away from him.
All right, now he's handcuffed.
Well, Danton, that was a very good performance.
Well, thank you, Lecoq. It was a pleasure.
Who is that man? He's the image of André Coudray.
This is Philippe Danton from the Comédie Française.
How do you do?
Very good actor.
How do you do?
Well rehearsed and perfectly made up. You know, I'm almost ashamed to work this ancient trick, having an actor pretend to be a ghost. But it did work.
Oh, don't boast, Monsieur Lecoq. You had little to do with the success of your trick. The little pig André Coudray made your trick work.
Are you trying to tell me that a dead man helped us?
I believe he did. For the last three nights, I've dreamt a vivid dream, the same dream each night. I dreamt that André Coudray stood at the foot of my bed exactly as I saw this actor. Coudray did not speak in my dream, but when I heard his voice tonight, I was not surprised. I believe my dream had come true, that the apparition was really there, and that André Coudray wanted to know why I'd killed him, that if I told him, he would go and leave me in peace.
What? Are you really telling me the truth, that you actually dreamed of seeing André Coudray as you saw the actor Danton tonight?
Oh, what reason do I have to lie? You've got my confession now. It was not you, but the little pig André Coudray who trapped me.
And so, Monsieur Lahan, that is my file number 23. Do you think it will give you a good story?
Good story? It's amazing. Oh, by the way, you haven't told me how you came by the dog, Coquette.
Oh. Coquette, come here. You may leave your corner now. Come here, girl. Jean Ministre was so grateful to me for releasing him from facing the guillotine that he insisted on giving me his dearest possession, Coquette. She's a fine little dog.
Yes. You know, I'm afraid I'd make a poor detective. I lost sight of some of your clues. Now, what made you so sure that Jean Ministro was innocent?
Well, sometimes the things that are not seen are near enough to put the eyes out.
Yes.
You remember how I had observed that the night table, water, wine glass, and so on were all at the left side for convenience?
Mm-hmm.
But the letters we found on the floor, M-O-N-I-S, were at the right of the body, written with the right hand. Well, I later confirmed my first impression that Coudray was left-handed. And besides, the police commissioner had greeted me with the information that Coudray had been stabbed. But later, I asked Jean in his cell what he had done with the revolver, and he answered that he had thrown it into the River Seine.
Well, I suppose Clara was convicted as Victor's accomplice, wasn't she?
No, we suspected her, but suspicions are not proof. She denied knowing of Victor's affection for her, and we could get absolutely nothing against her. But always I have wondered, was Clara merely a clever, discreet woman and a good actress? Was she Victor's accomplice? What do you think?
From the time-worn pages of the past, we have brought you the story, The Murder of the Little Pig. Bellkeeper, toll the bell.
The Weird Circle, on Tuned to Yesterday from March 5th, 1944, on NBC. Adapting a story penned by renowned French author Émile Gaboureau, considered to be one of the fathers and pioneers of modern detective fiction alongside Edgar Allan Poe, and was a forerunner by about 20 years to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. In fact, after Conan Doyle's Adventures of Sherlock Holmes started reaching readers, Gaboureau's detective, Monsieur Lecoq, and his popularity faded quickly. The story we just heard was first published in 1867. You're listening to An Hour of Mystery on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for Nightbeat with Frank Lovejoy as star, an NBC episode from July 24th, 1950.
Wheaties presents Nightbeat. On stage tonight from Hollywood, Nightbeat. Another in the Wheaties' big parade of exciting half-hour presentations. Night Beat.
Hi, this is Randy Stone. I cover the Night Beat for the Chicago Star. Stories begin in many different ways. And sometimes when you start digging for the facts behind the story, you end up by finding that you've dug yourself a grave.
Night Beat, starring Frank Lovejoy as Randy Stone.
On a hot August afternoon back in 1936, young Bobby Feller stepped out on the mound and started his first major league game as a Cleveland Indian. He was just 17 years old. Bob, step up here and tell us what happened that day.
Well, Ed, I was really loaded with Wheaties for that game. I struck out 15 St. Louis Browns.
You think the Wheaties helped, eh, Bob?
Ed, I'll tell you, Wheaties always help. I've been eating them for pretty near 20 years, four or five times a week. And Wheaties with milk and fruit are still my favorite breakfast dish.
That's wonderful, Bob. Thanks for stopping by, and best wishes to our real Wheaties champion.
Yes, thank you, Bob Feller. And folks, did you hear what the man said? Wheaties always help. Now, you may not play baseball for a living, but you can use whole wheat energy, too. You try it. Breakfast of champions. Have some and see yourself how Wheaties at 7 can help at 11.
If anyone had told me once about seeing flying saucers in the sky, I'd have tagged him either as a joker or a candidate for the booby hatch. But nowadays, anything is possible, apparently. You know, you could tell me that you saw a little man from Mars 3 feet high, and I wouldn't disbelieve you. Because tonight, I saw someone almost as strange. Fred Mola's bookshop is a shabby little place amidst a teeming stretch of tattoo parlors and penny arcades. It was the book in his window that caught my eye as I was passing. An early edition Bible, richly bound in antique leather, hand-tooled and inlaid with heavy gold leaf. It stood out against the books that surrounded it like a 90-carat diamond in a display of 10-cent jewelry. I looked up, and there was Mr. Mola watching me through the dusty window with the smile of a man holding in his fear. And I went in. Hello.
A little early, aren't you?
Early? It's almost 10 o'clock.
I know.
I'm just looking at that old Bible in your window.
You are a collector of old Bibles, no doubt.
No, not exactly. I just happened to see that same book on Mr. Ron Heilman's living room floor the night he was murdered about 6 months ago.
I am aware of that.
You mind if I have a look at it?
You brought the money with you? No tricks?
No tricks. Look, all I want to do is see the book.
One moment.
How much do you want for it?
The price is still $50,000.
Are you kidding?
I said no tricks. We've already agreed on the price.
Oh, you've got your wires crossed. I haven't agreed to anything. Who do you think I am, anyway?
Aren't you the man?
The name is Stone, Randy Stone of the Chicago Star.
Oh, newspaper reporter. I'm sorry, Mr. Stone. I thought you were a messenger from one of my customers. He was supposed to be here at 10 o'clock.
Yeah, sure. If you don't mind my asking, why is this book worth $50,000?
Why, this, sir, is one of the finest volumes of its kind in existence, published in 1513 by Martel, the contemporary of Caxton.
Yeah, but I know enough about books to know that $500 would be plenty. Do the bloodstains on the cover increase the value?
Bloodstains?
Was lying on the floor in Heilemann's study when the police found the body. Ron Heilemann had been stabbed with a pair of desk shears.
Yes, a terrible thing. Murdered by his houseboy, wasn't it? A man named...
Canto. Willie Canto. That still doesn't make the book worth $50,000.
Well, there's something different about this book.
Oh, is that so?
Oh, this book is the Black Gospel.
Fine, thanks.
Don't rush away. It's very interesting. For instance, the first 12 sections are the first 12 books of the Bible. Can you read this old English script?
Well, not as well as an old Englishman, but I can try.
Read it.
And he burnt the house of the Lord at... What's this other stuff that follows on the next page? Hail to thee, Lucifer. What is this, anyway?
How don't you see? It's the beginning of the Black Gospel, the devil's Bible.
What's that?
Well, you see, in the year 1513, possession of this sort of literature was a sure passport to the gallows or the stake.
Hmm.
Now, here's the invocation to Satan himself, summoning him up from hell, which was considered the most potent of all the spells used in witchcraft.
Mr. Mola, why are you trying to keep me here?
Well,
You're not sure whether this messenger you're expecting at 10 will come with money or a gun, is that it?
Oh, really now?
Well, if you're afraid, why don't you call a cop? I got work to do. I can't stay here and play bodyguard.
Wait, please. The police wouldn't understand.
Well, if it's that kind of a deal, then all I can suggest is you make with a spell, call up the devil, let him protect you. I'm going.
Some of these prayers to Satan are remarkable, Mr. Stone. Here, let me read you one.
Oh, well, if it'll make you feel better.
Hail to thee, Satan, Lord of death. Praises to thee, Prince of destruction.
Uh-huh.
Let transgression of the wicked be glorified, and the purple testament of war be proclaimed. Take us, Lucifer, son of the morning, for we are thine.
Good evening.
Mola's eyes popped at the apparition that had appeared behind us. It came in soundlessly through the open door, a bearded man in a black turtleneck sweater, dark trousers, and black sneakers.
What do you want?
The book. I came to get the book.
What? What book?
The one you have there. The Devil's Bible.
Who sent you?
Don't answer that. Mr. Stone, if you don't mind, sir, this happened to be my business.
Virgil said it would be here.
Who?
Virgil, my guide.
Who are you?
Mr. Stone, I'm going to close in a few minutes, if you don't mind. Good night.
Oh, so this is your messenger. Now it's time to get rid of me. Is that it, Mr. Mola? What's your name, pal?
Dante.
Dante.
Did you bring the money?
Money? What money?
Well, this doesn't look like your $50,000 to me, Mr. Mola.
I need no money.
Get out of here.
Now, wait a minute. Dante, what's your last name?
I am Dante Alighieri.
The 14th century Italian poet who wrote The Divine Comedy.
Ah, he's a madman.
Yeah, but he writes like a dream.
It was Virgil who took me to purgatory. My Beatrice led me through paradise. We walked with the angel.
First it's a newspaper reporter, now it's a lunatic.
Princes of hell, Zamiel, Asmodeus, and Apollyon, they are powerless before me. Their testament is mine. Now give it to me.
Get out of here.
I tell you, it's mine. Mine.
Take your hands off
it. Easy, Danny. Let go. That's better.
Now get out.
The fawn in the turtleneck sweater left reluctantly, looking back over his shoulder as he eased out the door and slipped off into the night. And as I watched him go, I had a funny feeling that somewhere, sometime, I'd seen that strange, thin face with the high cheekbones and the pointed ears before. I headed for the garage to pick up my car. I wondered where he'd gone and where he'd come from. And then suddenly, there across the street, leaning against a lamppost, staring back at the light still shining in the bookshop window a block away, I spotted him. I stepped off the sidewalk and hurried toward him. He turned abruptly, and I called, "Hey, Danny, wait!" But he fled into the darkness. When I got to the office, I figured that Mola's little bookshop might make the basis of a human interest yarn if I tied it in with the breakup of the late Ron Heilemann's famous book collection. So I had our librarian, Benny Marcus, dig out the files on the case from the morgue. I found something that made me do a fast take.
What is it, Randy?
Well, I was just looking at the picture on this story.
Huh? Oh, Mrs. Beatrice Heilemann, huh? Ain't bad, is she? Young enough to be Heilemann's daughter instead of his widow. Well, they say he was the connoisseur.
No, that's not the picture I'm looking at. This one, Willie Canto.
Huh? Hey, what are you doing?
I'm just drawing a set of whiskers on Mr. Canto's skinny face.
Randy, what kind of fool is this?
Look, Benny, look. I just brought a dead man back to life.
What are you talking?
Willie Canto with a beard or his double. If it is Willie, I'd better get over to Mola's bookshop, but quick.
Well, why?
He's killed one man already. Fred Mola could be number two. I'd have called the police if I hadn't been afraid of raising a false alarm, which proves that silence is sometimes a poor substitute for brains. It was raining as I pulled up in front of Mola's bookshop. I saw that his lights were still on. The black gospel had not been replaced in the window. When I went in, it was neither on the counter nor anywhere that I could see. The place was deserted. I walked to the door of the back room and knocked. Mr. Mola? Mr. Mola? Where's that light switch? Ah. Well, it's his office. He must have... Mr. Mola. The old man lay sprawled on the floor. I knelt beside him. His body was still warm, but he was quite dead. A small black bullet hole in the center of his forehead explained why. When Willie Canto showed up at old man Mola's bookshop, I didn't recognize him at first. After all, he was supposed to have drowned himself after he killed his boss, Ron Heilemann. I hurried back to the bookshop and found that Mr. Mola was dead, a bullet through his head, and the book he'd been trying to sell for $50,000 gone. I reached for the phone. The phone is dead. You must have cut the wire.
Yeah, I did.
Oh. Willie Canto.
My name is Dante Alighieri.
Oh, yes, yes, I remember that. You've been standing behind the door all this time, pointing that gun at me?
Yes.
Now, look, Dante.
Don't come any closer. I must kill you.
Why? You usually kill your friends.
You're no friend.
But I am.
Oh, then why did you plot to harm my Beatrice?
Beatrice? Oh, yes, Dante and Beatrice. I forgot.
You've made spells against my Beatrice, but you are finished. You must die. The book can't save you now.
Now, wait a minute. Let's talk some more, Donnie, old boy. So you've got the book, huh?
No. Virgil has taken it.
Virgil? Oh. Oh, sure. Virgil, of course. Your guide through hell and purgatory. Where is he now? On the Chinatown at night run?
That's enough of talk. It makes my head hurt. Yeah. You must die.
You don't want to kill me, Daddy Chum. If you killed me, you'd be a murderer.
No.
You'd never see paradise with Beatrice. You'd go to hell.
No.
Give me the gun, Canto.
No. No.
We stood facing each other about 12 feet apart while he struggled with himself. I couldn't afford to wait. A little pressure on that trigger and I'd be featured in the obituary column. I tensed for a spring and then... Willie Canto's gun hand fell to his side, and his dark eyes were suddenly filled with tears. I stepped forward and took the automatic from his long fingers.
I should kill you, but I cannot. I cannot.
Well, don't feel too bad about it. I don't. Now, let's get on out of here and go for a little drive. The fresh air will do us both good. Ah, the rain stopped. There's my car. Hey, Willie, come back here. Canto, come back or I'll shoot. I wasn't going to, of course, but on the bare chance it might give him pause, I pointed the gun to the sky. The shot seemed to give him jet propulsion. He dived into an alley and vanished. I turned around and headed back toward my car. I got there just as a couple of prowl cars pulled up behind mine.
Stone!
Huh? Well, Sergeant Blank.
No, it was you who called the police. Why didn't he give you a name? You bashful or something?
I haven't had a chance to call anybody yet.
Well, somebody called. He said that some guy just killed a fellow that runs this bookshop. What are you doing with that gun?
Oh, don't look at me like that, Buzz. It belongs to a fellow who was found dead in the river 3 months ago.
Well, who gave it to you?
He did.
Huh? What are you talking about?
Willie Canto, the fellow who killed Ron Heilerman. He's as big as life and he's twice as crazy.
You're the one who's crazy. Everybody in the Heilerman household identified Canto's body. His wife, his secretary, John Talbot, the butler, the gardener.
So they made a mistake.
Then we better go out and have a talk with Mrs. Beatrice Heilerman. If Canto's on the loose, he may be planning to call on her.
Mind if I come along? The Heilerman estate featured a lot of formal gardens, two or three guest cottages, and a mansion about the size of Mount Vernon. The only thing that could have made the interior more early American was a stuffed Indian over the mantelpiece. Tears shimmered in Beatrice Heilerman's lovely violet eyes as Sergeant Black told her what had happened.
Oh, poor Willie. I guess I was wrong when I identified that body as his. But even John Talbot, my husband's secretary, thought it was he.
I don't want to alarm you, Mrs. Heilerman, but there's a chance Canto may show up here.
Oh, but Willie wouldn't harm me. Why, he was always devoted to me.
He was devoted to your husband, too, but look what happened.
I still can't believe it. My husband was so kind to him, so gentle. He even tried to teach Willie to understand some of those dull books of his.
Like Dante, huh?
Dante? Why, that was my husband's nickname for Willie. How did you know?
Willie thinks he is Dante.
Oh?
Uh-huh.
Ron was always giving people the names of characters in his books. Sometimes I don't think they were very complimentary. But I was never too sure.
Who was Virgil?
Virgil?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Wait a minute. That's what he called his secretary.
John Talbot?
Yes, Mr. Talbot.
John Talbot, Virgil.
Hmm?
I suppose he doesn't work here anymore.
Yes. I've needed him to help me wind up my husband's estate. There were so many things to be done. Why?
Does he live here on the premises?
Yes, but he isn't in town now. Poor man's been working so hard cataloging the rest of those books that I told him to take a week off. He left yesterday.
I see. Where'd he go?
He mentioned something about fishing in Minnesota.
Well, thanks, Mrs. Heilerman. Homicide will probably talk to you about this further, but in the meantime, keep your doors and windows locked, just in case.
Oh, I'll be careful. Thank you.
When we stepped out into the night, it began to rain again. Sergeant Black drove off to make his report to headquarters, and I stopped to light a cigarette and try to make some sense out of the mess. And then I saw a dim figure emerge from a side entrance to the big house. The figure of a man standing momentarily in a yellow fuzz of light that shone from the open door. A small, familiar silhouette. The door closed and the darkness swallowed him, but there was no doubt about it. It was Willie Canto. I jumped out of the car. Willie! I caught sight of a shadowy figure as he whirled and ran toward the back. Willie! He headed toward the guest cottages, barely visible in the faint glow of a distant street lamp, and for a moment I lost him. Then I heard him leap across the veranda of one of the cottages, and I charged after him. He didn't have time to bolt the door in my face. Willie, what's the matter with you? Just want to have a word. Where are you? Turn on the light. Where's the switch?
Wait.
Well, that's better. What are you scared of?
You! You're the police.
What gave you that idea?
I heard you. In the house. You were talking to my Beatrice.
Oh, I see. She knew you were there all the time, didn't she?
Why, yes, of course. I was in the next room.
Well, I'm not with the police. I'm just a broken-down reporter. So put that nice big knife down, Willie.
Huh?
First a gun, then a knife. You're a bad boy, Willie.
What do you want of me?
That knife, put it on the dresser, and then we'll talk. Yeah, that's better. Now, what were you doing out there in the rain?
Going away. Far away.
Why?
She says, if I love her, I will go away. Farther than before.
Than before? Where was that? Where have you been spending the last 6 months?
On the island.
What island?
Where Mr. Heilerman has his summer cottage.
So she told you to go there?
Yes. She's so kind. She gives me money. She sends me food. But it's so lonely. I had to see her. Why does she tell me to go? She told me before. She loved me.
Beatrice doesn't change. She's kind and generous. Her heart is like gold.
Yes, yellow and hard.
What?
Did she ask you to kill Mr. Harlan?
Oh, no. I wouldn't kill her. Yes. Yes, I killed him. It was me. I killed him.
Pretty mean, wasn't he, Willie?
Oh, no. He was a nice man.
You kill people who are nice to you?
No, I wouldn't. I killed him.
Beatrice wouldn't want you to lie, not even for her sake. She'd want you to tell the truth, Willie. Did the secretary stab Mr. Harlan?
No.
But he killed a man in the bookshop.
Yes.
And you know who killed the man who was so good to you, Mr. Heilerman, don't you? Don't you, Willie? You know. You saw it, didn't you? You know who killed him.
Yes, I know.
Go on, Willie. Tell me. Tell me what you saw.
I saw through the door into the library. Mr. Heilerman was there and Beatrice.
Yeah? What were they doing?
He says he knows about Beatrice and Virgil. He says he will get a divorce.
Yeah? Go on. Then what happened?
She picked up the scissors and... No. I did it. I did it.
She told you to say that, didn't she?
I
What happened after she stabbed
him? She ran out of the room. I went in. And Mr. Heilerman was trying to get up. He said, Willie, get me some paper. Some paper. Well, there was no paper. There was only the book. My book. And I put it on the floor so that he could write.
The Black Gospel?
Yes. Yes, he wrote in it. On the empty page in front, he said, give this to the police. They will know who killed me.
Why didn't you?
I was afraid. For Beatrice. And she comes in again, and Mr. Talbot is with her. They say that I must go away.
You never told them what Mr. Heilerman wrote in the book? No, of course not. They'd never sold it with the rest of the collection.
I don't remember. Everything is all mixed up.
So that's why it was worth 50 grand.
What? What do you say?
Nothing, Willie. So they identified that body as yours, hoping the police had dropped the search. Well, you're lucky to be alive.
Mr. Storm.
Everything falls into place. Not a pretty picture, but it's clear enough.
That's unfortunate, Mr. Stone.
It was our old pal, John Talbot, the secretary. He stood in the open door of the next room, framed against the darkness. I hadn't seen him since the inquest on Heilerman's death, but he hadn't changed. He was a slender, handsome man, looking like a college professor in tweeds and rimless glasses, the type generally pictured carrying a pipe or a book. But what he was carrying was a snub-nosed .38 revolver.
A touching little tale, Willie.
Virgil!
Does that gun mean I should have knocked before entering?
Opportunity is always welcome, Mr. Stone, whether it knocks or not.
Opportunity for what?
To dispose of an unforeseen problem.
Oh, meaning me, I suppose.
Meaning both of you.
It's Beatrice. Her footsteps.
John, it's all right. They've gone. I've been waiting for you. Oh, Mr. Stone. Willie.
Beatrice, I was going away, but Mr.
Shut
Stone...
Shut the door.
John, what is this? Why the gun?
It seems that your faithful Dante has been talking to this newspaper fellow.
What?
Rather extensively, I'm afraid.
Willie, have you gone crazy?
Oh, Mr. Stone wouldn't harm you, Beatrice. You wouldn't touch her, would you, Mr. Stone?
Uh-uh. Not without gloves.
What did he tell you, Mr. Stone? That lunatic. And you believe him? John, is that why you're holding a gun? You fool. What does it matter what Willie said about me? There's no proof.
You consider yourself safe just because I destroyed that wretched book. Oh, no, my dear. That's not enough. I've got to silence them.
Put away that gun!
Let go of me, you little fool. This fellow knows too much.
I can't stand anymore.
Let go. Let go of my arm.
So many terrible things. I can't stand it anymore.
I said let go.
Oh!
You hit her. You hit her.
Willie, no.
I'll kill you.
Get back and drop that knife.
Willie Canto staggered as I leaped forward and knocked the gun from Talbot's hand. Talbot reeled backwards and sat down heavily on the sofa behind him. It was then that I saw the dagger in his side and the red stain spreading. Beatrice stood with her back against the wall, her eyes wide, staring at Talbot, and then at Willie lying doubled up on the floor. And suddenly she gave way. I snatched up the gun and went to the phone. As I reached for it, I saw that Willie had risen to his hands and knees, his thin face glistening with sweat. He began to crawl towards Mrs. Heilman, one hand reaching out for her, his eyes glazed with pain.
Beatrice. My Beatrice.
No!
Beatrice.
Don't touch me!
Beatrice!
Keep away! I can't stand you! No! No! No!
Beatrice, come back! Oh, please! Please! My Beatrice!
Dante's Inferno. Yep. Hello, operator. Get me the police. Well, the clock hands are converging on four, pinching out the last hours of the night. The rain has stopped and a new moon is out. No lover's moon, but thin and curving, like a knife or a dagger. The curved dagger that Willie Canto used. Poor Willie. He wasn't the first who was betrayed by what he thought was love. Love is like eating mushrooms. You don't know whether it's the real thing until it's too late. Oh, well. Copy, boy.
Nightbeat, starring Frank Lovejoy, is produced and directed by Warren Lewis and edited by Larry Marcus.
Nightbeat, on Tuned to Yesterday from July 24th, 1950 on NBC. And that brings the curtain down on this hour of mystery on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.